This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Elder abuse takes many forms, from physical to mental, financial to sexual. To help protect the elderly in Kentucky, last November, then-Governor Steve Beshear signed an emergency regulation requiring 1,300 healthcare providers for the elderly to obtain national background checks for new employees starting this year. And joining us to discuss elder abuse and ways to prevent it are Vice President of Communications for the Council on Aging of Southwestern Ohio, Lori Petrie, Attorney at Law for Pro Seniors, Amy Kurlansky, Associate Director of Human Services for the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, Ann Wildman, and Long-Term Care Ombudsman for the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, Bethany Breckel. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find it on Facebook or Twitter. And Lori, would you start off by telling us what exactly is elder abuse?
Elder abuse takes the many forms. We have physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, self-neglect, which
self-neglect.
Is, okay. Self-neglect is very common, just what it sounds like. It's, in fact, the most common form of elder abuse that's reported to Adult Protective Services Agency. This is where the older adult is not eating, not bathing, neglecting their basic health and living for whatever reasons. It might be dementia, it might be mental illness, or other reasons. And then there's financial exploitation, which has been a growing problem in recent years, partially because of the economy, partially because of a huge surgence in frauds and scams against seniors. And in the financial exploitation realm, there's both by people the older person knows, family member, caregiver, or by a stranger, such as telephone scams or internet scams.
How common is financial exploitation?
It's very common. The Health Path Foundation of Ohio has recently done, they've done some really good studies, the Ohio Family Violence Project, and they estimate that 5% of older Ohioans have suffered some form of financial exploitation.
Amy, what are some of the common triggers for elder abuse? And why do we hear about sometimes happening in a home or a facility setting?
Well, and let me just explain, my role at Pro Seniors is exclusively to work with people who have had financial exploitation situations occur. Just so you know as well, all of these types of elder abuse are a subset of domestic violence in a lot of cases, because as Lori just said, you have caretaker or family abuse, but you also have the stranger abuse, which are the scams. There are any number of risk factors for the seniors. A lot of it is because most of the wealth that people have is concentrated in individuals who are in the senior age range. So as Lori said, some of their family members hit hard times, or unfortunately in our area we're seeing a lot of drug-related incidences. My caseload in particular, I've seen a lot of family members who feel that they have the right to misuse their powers of attorney. That's a large problem. And to steal, essentially, steal from their loved ones. I have had at least one client who had a home health aide who stole from her. That person is actually being prosecuted. But it is on the rise. And the individual home health aide, the one that's being prosecuted, hers was drug-related. She very clearly had a drug problem, and she was stealing from a number of her clients.
And how widespread is elder abuse?
I think that it's very widespread. We see it a lot in Northern Kentucky, not just in, and Bethany can speak specifically to how often she is receiving reports from the nursing facilities. So not just within the nursing facilities, but we serve the general population of older adults. So we see it a lot with the individuals that we case manage and in the community. And I would agree with what Lori had to say about financial exploitation. That is becoming a very increasingly large issue in our communities.
Is it the fastest growing area of abuse?
I don't have statistics on that, but you hear about it so much more often.
There's, and I think that one of the things to build on what Ann was saying is that it's way, even though it's so widespread, elder abuse, it is way underreported. So, for example, the Ohio Family Violence Prevention Project estimates that about each year, 105 thousand older Ohioans is abused or neglected. And yet, if you look at the number of reports that come to an organization, an Adult Protective Services, or that even make their way to ProSeniors for prosecution, financial exploitation, so you only have about 8,000 reports annually that are made to Adult Protective Services agencies for investigation and possible prosecution. So you can see it's way underreported, and the awareness level is not where it needs
to be.
Why is it
so underreported?
There's a number of reasons. Yeah, let Amy, yeah.
Amy
answer
go
that.
Ahead.
Yeah.
That's okay. I was going to say they believe it's as underreported as 1 in 20 cases. And in 2013, statewide in Ohio, there were about 13,000 reports to APS, Adult Protective Services, and that's all kinds of abuse. But some of the reasons that people believe it's underreported is the difficulty in reporting for some of the seniors. You're talking about very vulnerable individuals who are talking, you know, these are their trusted caretakers for the scenarios where it's a loved one, a family member, or a caretaker. Those are people they trust. And to have to call a report in and you know, alert the authorities that they're being abused is a very difficult thing for a number of people. When it's different scenarios, and I've spoken to a number of different community groups about some of the different areas of abuse, scams and frauds, people don't like to report those because there's a shame factor, unfortunately. They don't want to believe that this has happened to them. Some of the things like investment fraud, for example, you're talking largely men over 50 who are targeted in those types of scenarios, and these are often extremely educated, extremely resourceful individuals who have had these kinds of abuse happen, and to admit that happened is a difficult thing for a lot of people. For some of the other individuals, you know, if they're in a nursing facility or long-term care, they're often ill and vulnerable and don't know where to turn.
Well, is one of the problems too, Amy, that the people who see this and suspect it might be going on, that it's difficult for them to get involved, that they're reluctant themselves to say something?
A lot of the different, well, it depends on what's going on, but a lot of the times you have people who are mandatory reporters involved, and they may not recognize all of the signs, especially when it comes to financial exploitation. People don't necessarily see it until a lot has happened. Or, you know, in the alternative, I had one client who her accountant alerted everyone that she was being pressured by some other individuals to give them money. She insisted that this was not the case. She insisted that she was giving things freely of her own free will, and that makes it difficult to intercede. And her accountant did what he's supposed to do, which is report it to the appropriate authorities, but if she refused to acknowledge that there's a problem, that makes it difficult.
So how often does abuse in a private home involve someone who's a family member, a son or a daughter or a parent?
I don't know what everyone else is seeing, but that is the largest number of situations I'm seeing.
I would completely agree with that.
Yeah.
Bethany?
Yeah. Yeah, I would too.
Yeah.
You're seeing that a lot, financial exploitation.
We were talking about some of the biggest reasons, and I would agree that Bethany and I were talking about this just the other day about the fear factor. And I think that in facilities, and Bethany could probably speak to this a little bit better because she receives the reports directly, but I think that fear of individuals that are in facilities, they don't want to leave that place. They're afraid of reporting. They're afraid of getting that person in trouble. Maybe Bethany can talk a little bit better because she gets those reports directly. But I asked how often, you know, Bethany, how often do you get, you know, a report? She gets at least one a week. And sometimes more.
Yeah, and it can just vary from any of the abuse situations. It doesn't necessarily have to be financial. It could be misappropriation of their funds or missing items or, you know, or anybody unknown origin of a bruise or anything. You're going to get reports on that.
I think it's really important to say that what we'll call direct care workers, individuals who are in someone's home or in a facility where they're working directly and have access to that person both physically, maybe to their financial information and records, that most direct care workers are trustworthy and good people. But there are some who, especially, you know, they're marginally employed. They're not well paid. It's a difficult job, and many of them, temptation is placed in front of them, and they simply can't avoid it. There's money laying around in the home. There are important documents laying around that have private information. There may be jewelry. There may be cash. And we always encourage our clients and the providers who work with them that it's important to have a friendly relationship with your home health aide, but do hide your valuables. Do keep your financial records private and not laying around. And keep a professional boundary. Don't be lending money to your aide. Don't be giving financial gifts. That's prohibited. And these boundaries can get crossed as friendships develop. And then you have a situation where maybe there's a theft or an inappropriate gift, and the older person doesn't want to prosecute. This is my friend.
As an organization that provides the same type of services as the Council on Aging of Southwestern Ohio, I would completely agree with Lori's advice.
Hey, Amy, what kind of oversight and credentialing and background checks, that kind of thing, do caregivers go through in Ohio and Kentucky?
I can't speak to Kentucky. I'm not licensed.
And maybe Ann or Bethany can help us with that. Okay.
Yeah. I know that I believe your governor just signed, in Kentucky, your governor just signed some new regulations. Ohio's not quite as strict. I don't have the revised code sections at my fingertips, but I know there's a basic background check that's done. But if, for example, the client I have, and I do have permission to speak about her situation, the client whose home health aide stole from her, I don't know that the agency did a very thorough background check on that particular person, because a cursory one of just checking the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts showed some things that were red flags to me, and yet she was still employed by that agency and then stole essentially from my client, and she's facing, the grand jury has indicted her on theft charges. And let me just clarify something really quickly, because I think someone said prosecute and proseniors in the same sentence. So we're a civil agency. It's the prosecutor's office, the Hamilton County prosecutor's office, is pressing those charges. So I'm helping my client through some other aspects of that process, but the prosecutor's office took that to the grand jury, and they've indicted the caretaker on those charges. But again, just a simple check of the clerk of court's website showed a few other things that for me were red flags that the agency that particular person was hired by didn't seem to have problems with.
And Bethany and Ann, what about Kentucky? What kind of credentialing and oversight is there? And how much of an impact is the new law that just went into effect going to have?
So the new law is going to have a huge impact. The new law was actually signed into legislation on November 20th of 2015 and then it went into effect on January 1st of this year. And essentially, prior to the new law, which is known as the CARES, K-A-R-E-S legislation, CARES stands for Kentucky Applicant Registry and Employment Screening. And prior to this law going into effect in Kentucky, the requirement was to run a state background check on anyone that would work in any type of facility. That would be a nursing home, assisted living, a licensed personal services agency, which other folks would know as a home health agency, any type of agency that would provide direct care.
Or so employ, home providers are covered in this.
Right. Employ direct care workers. That is correct. So what has changed in the new law is that any new employee would be required to have a national fingerprint check, an FBI check, and that would be required.
Any idea how many other states have that same requirement?
I do not know.
Bethany, what kind of an impact do you think this new law is going to have? Is it going to help the matter?
I think it will. I think having the new staff being fingerprinted, and it'll also help because we are the border state with Ohio and Indiana as well. So it'll make sure that those staff members that can go from one state to another, caregiver, it'll help with that.
Yes, Bethany was just talking about an issue not too long ago where there was a worker in a nursing facility and they didn't catch that she had a criminal offense in the state of Indiana. Had this been in effect, they would have caught that.
They would have caught that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a number of... Oh, go ahead, Amy.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, do you all know how broad that is? Like, is it every direct care staff in your facilities now in Kentucky, or...
It is, Amy. It is. It would be all direct care staff in all of our nursing homes, intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual disabilities, all of our adult day assisted living facilities, our personal service agencies, which would be our home health agencies. They all have to be licensed under our Office of Inspector General. Any providers of home and community-based services are licensed personal care homes, and any staffing agencies that staff nurses, CNAs, home health aides, et cetera.
What prompted Governor Beshear to enact this? Was he really seeing some huge problems in the system?
I think so. They were looking at the numbers, and since May of 2014, there had been more than 2,600 complaints through our long-term care provider system, and 30% of those complaints were directly related to suspected abuse or exploitation of older adults. And so there was a very strong concern there, and I think that's what triggered that.
We're talking about elder abuse, ways to spot it, and ways to prevent it with the Vice President of Communications for the Council on Aging of Southwestern Ohio, Lori Petrie, Attorney at Law for Pro Seniors, Amy Kurlansky, Associate Director of Human Services for the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, Ann Wildman, and Long-Term Care Ombudsman for the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, Bethany Breckel. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Amy, what are the telltale signs of elder abuse, be it physical or psychological or sexual? What kind of signs should people be looking for?
There are a number of different signs, and as I said, there's usually a correlation. I hate to say that. So physical abuse is pretty much what you would think it would be, unfortunately. Any signs are unexplained injuries, bruising. I think Lori mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm. Broken bones, sprains, if people have broken eyeglasses or dentures, things like that, they in and of themselves may not mean that abuse is happening, but they're things to look for. One of the big things, and again, I mentioned earlier, all of this is a type of domestic violence. So especially for those individuals in the community, if their caretaker does not allow anyone else to see them alone, that's usually a red flag for me. And again, that goes across. I used to work as a guardian ad litem for abused children, and it's the same with abused children, abused spouses, and unfortunately abused seniors. If their caretaker will not let you see them alone, that's a problem. Some of the other signs, especially with all of these types of abuse, are if your client or if the senior is reluctant to see somebody. If they used to have a really great relationship with, I'm going to just arbitrarily pick a grandson. They used to have a great relationship with that grandson, and then kind of what seems like out of nowhere, they no longer want to see that person. That can be a sign that there's a problem there. What that problem is might take a little very careful delving into, but it's usually at least a sign that there's some kind of problem. Regarding financial exploitation, things to look for are withdrawals out of the senior's account that can't be accounted for. If the senior suddenly changes all of their, they're called advanced directives, so powers of attorney or financial instruments that give other people authority to access their records and their accounts, if all of those things change suddenly without explanation, that can be a sign. Obviously, you know, if things are just missing, if physical items are missing or cash is missing, jewelry is missing, those are some signs. One of my, I don't want to say favorite, it's not favorite because these are not good things, but a good illustration is I had a client who was in hospice. He was bedridden, but even so, ATM withdrawals kept occurring on his account, and it was clearly not him. So those are the kinds of things that are obvious red flags, but those are the kinds of things to look for with the people you care about.
I think in the area of self-neglect, the signs are obvious, but it's not as easy to do anything about it if the older adult is resistant. Many people, including family members of an older adult who may see the self-neglect, which again is very common, and they'll say, well, why can't you just put grandpa in a nursing home? And you really can't. This is an adult. It's not like child abuse. And if he is in command of his mental faculties for the most part, then he has some self-autonomy, and you may feel that he's making bad decisions about his own health. But it's important to remember that he's an adult and has rights as such.
Correct.
Kathy sent us an email and says that her father lived out of state with her estranged sister, who was abusing him and took his dogs away as punishment. She called local police, who said that wasn't abuse. So her question is, you know, what can you do to protect a loved one if that loved one's out of town?
Well, that's really hard. I mean, she did what she could, which was to call the police. But I think many times it's very difficult if you're an out-of-town caregiver and people find that they simply have to get in town and do something about a situation that can't be dealt from a distance. And you may have to intercede. Law enforcement isn't necessarily going to be involved if it doesn't rise to that level. And so the family has to take matters into their own hands as best they can.
But in Kentucky, you would you could call Adult Protective Services.
And in Ohio as well. If
yeah, you can call community. You can call Adult Protective Services. But again, it's not always going to be investigated as an abuse situation. It may be an unsafe situation, but it may not rise to the level of an abuse situation.
So how important is it for people to remember it's not that you're not verifying that there's abuse going on, right? You're just calling in your suspicions. Is that how it should
correct
be viewed?
Correct. And in Kentucky, Kentucky is a mandatory reporting state, meaning that all individuals, if they suspect abuse or neglect, are required to report.
And same with Ohio.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And if you think that a family member or a friend or neighbor is going through an abusive situation, what is the most sensitive, effective way to address it?
Well, sometimes you have to bring sometimes you have to bring in a third party. Several people have given an impartial parties have given examples where in financial exploitation, where the older adult themselves may be unwilling because of a friendly relationship to press charges against an individual. And so I know situations where Adult Protective Services has been called, and their strategy has been to get an impartial third party, like the person's physician or their banker, to step in. A situation that I was aware of where a woman was allowing these neighborhood boys to take her money and live with her, and she was really kind of running out of her money. APS was at their wit's end because she would not press any charges against these boys. And so they brought in her banker, who sat down with her and said, you are going to be forced to leave your home if you continue to give away your financial resources or allow them to steal from you, which is what they're basically doing. And that she saw the situation then from this individual who she trusted, and she kicked the boys out.
It varies from situation to situation. I had a gentleman whose daughter was living in his home. She was no longer welcome to do so. She was essentially living off of him, his income, his home. And so I represented him to have her evicted. She would not leave willingly. Nothing would make her leave. So we had to get a court order to have her leave. But he was very cooperative, and that was what his end goal was. So that was, I consider that one a success story. There are so many other clients who back off before, you know, I can get them to the point where we would need to file something in court, protective orders. I've had clients back off before filing a protection order for their own safety. It really varies from client to client and situation to situation. And I know, at least in my work with the seniors so far, often it takes more than one meeting. often they'll come to my office multiple times, and I find it best practice to meet with them alone. More often than not, they're not the ones bringing themselves to the meeting. They're coming with somebody. And even if that's someone they trust right now, just given the totality of circumstances, I think it's best to meet with them alone. So I'm always happy to tell my clients, I'll be the bad guy. I will tell your friend they have to wait in the lobby. I will tell your child they have to wait outside and that I can't talk to them, so that we can build that trust relationship and they can, more often than not, divulge more than their families even realized was going on. But it takes a long time to build up that trust.
So what are the resources? Where can people turn for help for someone who's being abused?
Well, in every county, and I assume the same in Kentucky, there are adult protective services agencies. They are underfunded, but they are available and they are helpful. And their telephone numbers in Hamilton County, Adult Protective Services is part of the Department of Job and Family Services, and the number there is 421-LIFE. And people, that's where someone would report an allegation of elder abuse or neglect.
And we have that phone number and links to those sources as well at WVXU.org. And Bethany, what about in Kentucky?
In Kentucky, their number is 859-292-6550. And then they also have a 1-800 number, and it's 1-800-752-6200.
So what about shelters? Are there shelters for the elderly who are being abused? I know Shalom Center.
That's the only one I know of in our area, and it's a wonderful service. It was opened several years ago, and they do take in individuals and provide them with a shelter who, you know, need to get out of a dangerous living situation. It's a wonderful service.
Anne, are there shelters in Kentucky?
We do not have specific shelters in Kentucky. However, we have a local Elder Abuse Coordinating Council. It is the Elder Maltreatment Alliance, a subgroup of our Elder Maltreatment Alliance. Involves a sheltering piece where we help people get out of that particular situation. So it is not a shelter, a physical location, but we can provide some limited financial assistance and some other things to help individuals get out of a dangerous situation.
And also, if I may add, in Ohio, if people have questions, legal questions about seniors and our services for people 60 and up, then feel free to call the ProSeniors hotline. We can connect people with the right resources. On the hotline, people can have a 30-minute free consultation, and there are no limits to the numbers of consultations with one of our hotline attorneys. If they feel that the case requires further intervention, then they can bring that to either me or one of our other in-house attorneys for further examination. So I'd love people to know about that service as well.
Well, thanks everybody for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Vice President of Communications for the Council on Aging of Southwestern Ohio, Lori Petrie, Attorney at Law for ProSeniors, Amy Kurlansky, Associate Director of Human Services for the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, Ann Wildman, and Long-Term Care Ombudsman for the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, Bethany Breckel. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Kevin Rowinski was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. January is a good time to think about your financial goals and come up with a plan to meet them. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss how to determine your current financial situation and how to better your chances of meeting your financial goals for the upcoming year. And we'll hear what's in store for Metro and improvements in Greater Cincinnati public transportation this year. That's Friday afternoon on Cincinnati Edition at 1 o'clock on 91.7 WVXU.